Session number 26584.
Roger Johnson, Reel 5. Can I just ask you a bit more about the camp in Dala? Obviously, that was the base for going out on these recce patrols. What else did you do from that camp?
Went out on night ambushes. So you had to, before you went out, you had to sort of jump up and down and make sure that nothing was rattling. And then you'd go out and try and prevent gun running and capture people. But we didn't. We weren't. We didn't have any success on that. Possibly because there were people in the camp that we employed who were actually telling everybody else, where we were going, what we were doing. So that wasn't very successful. But then, I wasn't in a war zone. I was in a zone where people threw lead at each other, but it wasn't officially a war. It was just a bit rough. And you stayed in your encampment, and the political officer, who was a white civilian, he would be killed every 3 months, and they'd renew him. So, it was the land of the gun. And honestly,
When you say the political officer,
political, yeah.
who was that, Royal Marine or
No, he would be a civilian. I don't
sorry,
know
so
from where.
civilian.
Yeah, political officer. I don't know from the Foreign Office or the Home Office, or I don't know. But he would be from London, and he would be white. Political officer, and he would just be bumped off constantly.
Who bought? I
Well,
mean,
just anybody.
by
Kids carry,
snipers?
well, no, Arabs. Everybody carried a gun. Children carried guns. It's a very match. The Arabs carry guns and knives, and if there isn't a war, they're bloody well sorted. They'll have one going by Saturday night. That's what they do. They raid each other. Instead of going to the football match, they go and have a shoot up. Yeah.
Any other operations which will run out of this camp?
No, patrols and digging. We dug underground ammunition dumps for us in case we were mortared, and then we dug a large underground first aid station, in case we were mortared and we had to casualties, and so everything goes underground. In a lot of the time in the military, you spend digging. Because you need to get down into the earth, underneath the earth, with protection on top of you to prevent, to keep you safe from high explosive shells and mortars and that sort of thing. So you dig down and then put in a couple of feet of cover over the top of you, and that's safe. It's a good place to be.
How long did you spend in the camp?
I suppose about 3 months out of 12 months in Aden, and then maybe 3 of those months up country in Dala, and going out on patrols and trying to be nice to the natives and patching them up. That's right. And at night shooting at anything that moved before it shot at you.
What about your time actually in Aden?
That was spent in wooden huts. They were even air conditioned, where we did our washing and our training. There was next door to us, I think, the 9th, 12th Lancers, so they would shoot around in armored cars and ferret cars and scout cars and light tanks or whatever they used. There were the inevitable parades and keeping fit and strong and weapon training. A lot of the life in the Royal Marines is waiting. Sort of hurry up and wait. Hurry up and get somewhere and then sit down. So you always carry a paperback book with you, because you could be lying on your back with your head on your pack on an airfield or just about anywhere on the earth. So you want to make sure that you've got a reading book with you, and you just stay there, and the night comes down and you get cold, and if you're lucky you may get something to eat, you may not get anything to eat, you may not get any clothing, any bedding at all, you may be detached from your equipment where your sleeping bag is. So in the forces, your soul may belong to Jesus, but your ass belongs to them. They kick ass. And they can't say, you can't say, well, I'm busy this Sunday, I won't be here. You're going to be there for 12 years, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You're always there. So you haven't got any rights. So, if they say, well, lay down there on this airfield and mount a guard and do your best to sleep, and then the answer is yes.
Any other memories of that time in Aden? How did you spend your free time? And
Killing scorpions, killing snakes, having fun, drinking beer, getting a monkey drunk so the monkey can't. So the monkey jumps at the tent pole, he can't find the tent pole. Drinking tinned beer. Drinking tinned, awful tiger beer. Dreadful. Letter writing. No phoning, no radio, no radio, obviously no TV. A radio, you may be able to tune your radio into the world. World Health Organization, World Service, you know. But you had to make your own entertainment. And if you were in somewhere like Dala, you were in an encampment for 3 months. And so you could not go out. It was too dangerous for you to go out. You did not go out. You'd have been shot and you'd have been killed. And in Aden, it wasn't much better. Although you could go downtown and do some shopping. Cheap, you know, you can get cheap cameras and watches and transistor radios, and it was really exciting because you were getting these things. They were being made in Japan. At that time, they were fairly rubbishy, but it was exciting to come back to the UK with a transistor radio. You know, people would say, "Wow, you know, where'd you get that from?" And you feel quite important, you know, that you're a world traveller. Of course, nowadays everybody travels, but it was exciting then. And you were supposed to be paying duty, bringing them back into this country. And you had to be careful when you went downtown, you know, because you'd get stoned. Not drinking stoned, but literally stoned, you know, chunks of rock. And you could always, you know, there's always a possibility of starting a full-scale riot because the Arabs didn't want you there. And it was hot. And there was no entertainment in Aden. The biggest treat you could get would probably be having a meal in a bottle of beer and a rather scruffy meal. You know, the year in the desert was like you'd committed a crime and you were sent out there as punishment. You know, it wasn't a lot of fun. But in actual fact, I have to admit that after half my time in Aden, I was given the opportunity to go on a flight to East Africa. And my friend Bogie Knight, who is the father of the lady who works in the Imperial War Museum, I was with him for the year in the desert. And in the evenings, we used to have a battery-operated record player. And so we would go off into the desert with a bottle of gin and sing songs. I would sing melody and he would sing sort of accompaniment. And now I am a singer. I am a competition solo singer. So this probably stemmed from our desert days of singing songs around a bottle of gin. So every night we did this. And so anyway, I was allowed a free flight to Mombasa for a couple of weeks, and I landed in Mombasa with a bag, they were called grips, it was a bag, grip handles, you know, with a few clothes in and a bottle of gin, and I put that behind a counter of a bar, and I just went out and just messed around for 2 weeks, you know, in Africa, and caught a dreadful dose of sandfly fever, you know, where if you move your eyeballs, you fall over. It's a good party trick, actually. You know, people are kind of say, well done, and buy them a free beer, and it's called Sandfly, and it kills. And so I had a couple of weeks there on Mombasa, on white silver sands in Mombasa. You can't believe what it's like there. The water is blue, and the sand is white. And it dazzles your eyes. And there's palm trees leaning out towards the sea, or leaning in, depending on the prevailing wind. That's Africa, and it's just heaven. It's just beautiful. It's so healthy. Whereas the desert is not healthy. It's hot, humid, and it's mucky. East Africa is just beautiful. Just a beautiful place. And I came back with sandfly fever. And the sergeant major caught me still lying in bed. You know, he said, "Well, what are you doing? You're still in bed then, Johnson?" And I said, "I can't move, sergeant major. I could not move my eyeballs." And I reported it to the corporal in charge of the room. And he was, "Oh, I'm going to be late for parade. You know, bugger you." So the sergeant major found me just rigid in bed. So I was stretchered off into the sick bay with sandfly fever. And the only symptoms I remember are that if you move your eyeballs, you have a party trick and you fall over. So that was I managed to cure myself of that. But you get You get very bronze. And there isn't much, there's no facilities for swimming because it's shark heavily patrolled. The waters, it's in the Indian Ocean, I think, and the waters are heavily patrolled by bloody big sharks, grey nurse and tiger sharks. And, you know, they eat first and they ask questions afterwards, you know, they will have you. And some of the areas, they have a, it's supposed to be safe for swimming, and they have shark nets around the bay. But, you know, if the shark net is worn out and a shark gets through the net, then he's going to yomp you. And sharks out there, of course, they're like everything else out there. They're hungry. And I remember being in helicopters, you know, flying low over the sea and thinking, you know, I hope this bloody helicopter doesn't ditch because, you know, there's 30 sharks in a shoal, you know, in the beautiful clear water. And in the helicopter, you can go out the door and see them there. And all the beaches were littered with the jaws of sharks that the fishermen had brought in. They probably caught the sharks, and then all over the beach there would be shark jaws and turtles, dead turtles and shark jaws, barracuda. You could see the barracuda going through the waves. As the waves broke, you could see the barracuda, which is salt water, and he's like rather like an arrow, and they go through at supersonic speed. And of course, barracuda are the saltwater equivalent of the piranha, which and the piranha is freshwater as in the jungles, and that's a fat fish. Both those fish, the piranha and the barracuda, are killer fish. They'll strip you. So there wasn't much opportunity for swimming. Fact, very few facilities there at all. It was grim. Whereas in the army and the air force, and probably a little bit in the Navy, they would go somewhere for 3 years. So they would establish schools, churches, folk club, swimming pool, schooling. But as we were Royal Marine Commandos, we were sort of, you know, first in, first out, you know, rum bum and baccy, bang bang. So you didn't get looked after. You came in there as a shop force to do a job, and so you've got no food. So you and you're cold and wet and you haven't got any sleeping accommodation. Tough. We don't really care because you're going to be in and out, and you're commandos anyway.
You were in Aden for about a year.
I did a year in Aden, that's right. That's right. Yeah. And I came back to this country, and I was actually quite frightened trying to cross the road because I'd not seen the busyness of the roads around King's Cross and St Pancras, and I was really quite scared, you know, holding two suitcases, trying to get across the road, when I wasn't practiced at dodging cars, because I'd come from the peace and the serenity of the desert with tanks, and helicopters and a whole silent way of life and camel trains, you know, swishing way through the night, and the great big feet of the camel. I mean, they're noise. They don't make any noise when camels move, and donkeys, and what other things? You've got the snakes. You've got the horned viper. You know, that's a horn, a flat-headed viper with horns on top that knocks its prey with its horns and then strikes. And you've got scorpions. I got bitten by a scorpion on the thumb. I picked up a tent at one time, and there I screamed, and they were there hanging from my left thumb was a scorpion. So being a highly trained Royal Marine commando, I jumped up into the air, screamed. And went, oh, panic, panic. And I ran towards the sick bay attendant, screaming all the time like a child. And he said, shut up, sit down. Because the more I run around, I could feel the poison pumping up my arm as I was running. And sort of, but nothing happened, you know. So I got bit by a scorpion. So, you know, it didn't materialize into anything serious. Desert scorpions are small and light yellow, light green. They're small. Jungle scorpions are the size of a saucer, and they're big and black. So it went anyway. When you're in the desert, then you don't sit down on a stone. You turn the stone, see if okay, because there might be a scorpion underneath. It's going to bite your bum. And if you put on your boots, then you shake your boots, make sure. And you get things like camel spiders. And a camel spider is his jaw opens in four sections. And they're great big hairy things, and they walk along the inside of your tent, you know, ready to drop on you. So, you know, the wildlife out there is quite dangerous. Snakes.
Around about this time, about 1963-ish, that you've got involved in a rather unusual project with a toy company.
That's right. That was back in this country.
Can you tell me what happened
then? There was in a place called Limpston in Devon, Infantry Training Centre, and I was we lived in huts in those days, and I was a climber. And along came a man from Pedigree Dolls. Pedigree used to make very posh prams. If you were a posh person and you had a good pram, it would be a Pedigree pram, and they made toys. So there was a big, large man in a suit, and he looked around these climbers, and he said, "I want that man there. His face has got character." So he said, "Righto, Johnson, go away, get changed, and do what this man tells you." So I got changed into my commando gear, climbing commando gear, which is over there, and then somebody took photographs of me. And this chap went away and made a little fellow called Tommy Gunn. And Tommy Gunn, I think at the time, had a girlfriend, Cindy Doll, that sort of thing. So I was Tommy Gunn, she was Cindy Doll. And never the twain shall meet. And then Tommy Gunn became Action Man, and I didn't get anything for it. But then whenever I want to do, I've been involved in charities over the years, you know, the Guide Dogs, the Blind, Cystic Fibrosis and all sorts of things. So when I want to pull a stunt, when I want to get someone interested, I say, you know, I'll do a story about the Action Man doll. And, you know, just recently I've been signing autographs on the beach at Felpham and Bognor Regis. You know, it's a bit of fun and the kids love it. You know, the chance to get the Action Man's autograph. So it's a fun and I can use it to a good intent. I phoned up Honda UK years ago and I said, "Can I borrow a motorbike to do a charity trip?" They said, "Well, we get 11 requests every week. Tell us what's so special about you." So I said, "Well, you know, I'm the Action Man." So they lent me a motorbike. So
did you know that you were going to be used for a doll or?
Yes, but you know, I didn't make anything of it. I'm making a lot of it now because it's a way of bringing in money but not at the time. It was just, you know, what a puffy thing to do, you know, stand there, "Hey, you know, Jono's going to be a doll," you know, and that sort of, I played it down, you know, I wasn't particularly proud of that.
Did they just photograph you in your uniform?
Yeah, two front, back and left and right side. So.
Action Man is known for his rippling muscles, I just wondered.
For his what?
Rippling muscles.
Rippling muscles, I haven't got any of those. But I mean, I still do, I'm, you know, at my age now, at 62, I still do 70 press-ups every other day. So, you know, I keep myself fit and strong, yeah.
So they didn't make you strip off to sort of
no.
pictures of
you? I kept my clothes on. In those days, one kept one's clothes on. And so Action Man made a lot of money. In actual fact, you know, right now, Action Man is on sale in the shops. And he's still making hundreds of millions of pounds. He's been going for 40 years.
What was your reaction when you first saw the doll?
I was quite proud. I was quite proud that you know that it was based on me, but I've never haven't received any money. I've never had a cup of tea out of it, you know. So, but there we are. It's and I can't go wrong because wherever I go, everybody's had an Action Man doll, or you know, or the mums, you know, every boy's. And in actual fact, I think it's helped. It might have helped people. It might have given a license. I'd like to think it gave a license for boys to have a doll. Rather than have a doll and be accused of being puffy, so they could have an Action Man doll. Say, "Well, my Action Man's a tank commander, or he's a scuba diver, or he's a climber, or he's a parachutist." That was the favourite one, wasn't it? Yeah. So that may have given unwittingly, if you compare today with then, unwittingly, I might have actually promoted a boy to expose his slight feminine side. Because years ago, you know, we'll say Christmas time, a boy got a cowboy outfit, and his sister got a nurse's outfit. So he had a license to go running around going bang bang, and everybody pretended to fall over, and then his sister would come along as a nurse and mend everybody. So he was stereotyped. He had to be a killer, and she had to be a nurse. So a lot of guys didn't want to be cowboys and killers. You know, some guys wanted to be. Myself, I've been a nurse. You know. So I might have given them a boy a chance to be seen with a doll and not be ridiculed. And here we are now in 2003. And I've just done a long cycle trip to promote men to talk. So I'm prepared to, if need be, to be called a right old pufter or a soft boy, you know, because I'm seeking help. In actual fact, I'm not, because I could say, right, get your bicycle and a map, say goodbye to your mum for a fortnight and come with me and I'll show you what I can do. I've just done 1,000 miles on my own and it's been extremely dangerous and hard and dirty. And I reckon I've touched the hand of, or maybe God has touched my hand, you know, because I've been up high on my own in silence. I've done these things on a motorbike and a car, and they're not the same. On a bicycle, and the reason they call it a bicycle is because, or push bike, because you spend most of your time pushing your bike. And when you're pushing your bike, then you're starting to learn up in the mountains. Then you feel the mountains. So I'm proud of being the world famous action man. Yeah, I'm proud.
What happened to you after you returned from Aden?
I mean, 40 commando rings a bell. I don't even know where. I mean, supposing I was back in Bickley in 40 commando, and then we went out to sort out a riot, a mutiny in Dar es Salaam.
In Tanzania.
Tanzania, that's right. And we were on standby. Because all the special forces, you know, the special air service, the paras, the commandos, are all vying with each other in London, in the ministry. If the shit starts to hit the fan, the commandants of all those forces, they all want to get their men in first. So you go on, presumably, I think so. So that you go on to a standby. So your kit is packed. You're actually standing by to go to a theatre of war. You don't know. They won't tell you where. It's a secret. So then you're downtown, getting half stoned, excuse me, and a copper taps you on the shoulder, and by your appearance, because you're wearing a suit in those days and short hair, says, "Are you for 40 commando?" You say, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, you better get back now because you're being recalled." So you say, "Well, why is that?" The cop said, "Well, I don't know, just get back." So you get back, and then you get on a plane and you go out and you land in somewhere like Tanzania. Which is Zanzibar, Tanganyika. It used to be called Tanganyika and Zanzibar. It's Tanzania because it involves Zanzibar. And then you sort out a mutiny there because President Nyerere had been given his independence and his troops had started revolting. And when I saw them, I thought they were quite revolting too. And so you go out there and...
Were you prepared in any way for this? Or?
Well, you're prepared all the time. Let's say, you know, the commandos, like all the other special forces, you're training all the time.
So
what you can't train for is heat. I've actually experienced some of that, where you can go into artificial heat chambers. So you come from Bickley into Africa or the desert or Norway or whatever. So you can't train for the climate.
So you arrive in Tanzania.
Yeah. Dar es Salaam.
What happens then?
Well, then we went into a stadium, the national stadium, where we slept in tents in the stadium. So you've got 600 commandos in the stadium there, in tents. And we would go out on patrols and disarm. Other commandos were involved as well in firefighting. And then the object was to disarm the natives. And disarm everybody, taking weapons from everybody's house, because otherwise the bandits get in and take your weapon, you know, and use it against you or against the forces. So we put these weapons in massive, massive sheds, you know, I mean warehouses, you know, full of weapons. The weapons would be anything from Russian to Swedish, you know, from weapons from all over the world. So
these were house-to-house searches, effectively?
They would have been taken, yeah, from barracks and from houses, and people gave in their weapons anyway. And then the whites in Dar es Salaam were so pleased that the Brits had come out there, because they would have probably owned plantations. So if the natives had been running around, you know, they wouldn't have had a plantation. So they were so pleased. They asked you to come to the gate of the stadium, the national stadium, Dar es Salaam Stadium, and ask to take commandos out to, you know, can we take a couple of your men to the beach or to the cinema or to a banyan? A banyan is a party. Banyan is, I think, a party or a piss up or something like that on the beach, or a barbecue, you'd call them nowadays, you know, that sort of thing. So they say, you know, people are wanted, you know, volunteers are wanted to go to a beach party, and they go, "Oh no, not again, you know, bloody hell." And so I found myself once on the top of Barclays Bank, you know, doing a party up there on the flat roof, because it's in Africa, so you have flat roofs out there. So the whites would come out and ask to take us guys off and entertain us, because they were crying with relief that we were there to save them, because without us, then they could have lost their property. So we were the heroes.
Mm-hmm. Were you based in Dar es Salaam throughout that period, or did you go outside?
No, so we stayed in that stadium, and we had big warehouses of weapons and other warehouses of ammunition, and we disarmed people and we guarded these ammunition dumps and weapon dumps, and we were a really sort of talk of the town. And then I think we might have gone into Nairobi. So we were quite, you know, we were the saviours. And at that time, I remember there was there's something called the Safari, the East African Safari Rally. And I think as we were living in the stadium, and then I think Pat Moss, Sterling Moss was a racing driver, and he had a sister called Pat Moss, who was probably a rally driver. And so she came screaming into the stadium as part of the East African rally. And I think that's what I remember there. So we were thanked duly by President Nyerere of Tanzania and we got the place back to. I mean, the natives there, I'm calling them natives politely. I mean, they didn't understand weapons. They may be trying to mount a roadblock with the barrel of a machine gun and nothing else. They didn't understand that, you know, it takes more than a barrel. They weren't soldiers. They were just natives having a go at a mutiny, and it was falling to pieces. So we then flew back, the heroes, you know, and we flew over Mount Kilimanjaro. And it's strangely enough that one of the pilots, the co-pilot, came into the cabin and said, "Do you want to sit up in the front, the sharp end of the plane?" I said, "Cool, yeah." And then we flew over Kilimanjaro, so I was able to say to the pilot, "Hey, you know, a few years ago I climbed that and here I am flying over it."
What year would this have been, the Tanzania thing?
I honestly don't know, and I haven't been given time to do any homework on this. I've got photographs in there, but you know, unless you want to stop.
What's your next question,
then? I think you've looked at some photographs, and I think it was 1964 that you were in Tanzania.
Yes.
There was a particular story I think you wanted to tell about some guns.
Oh, some weapons, yes. I think it's probably safe to tell this story some 40-something years afterwards. But whilst, as commandos, we were guarding a weapons dump, I mean weapons dump, or a huge shed full of foreign weapons. So we would have to inspect the padlock.
This is in Tanzania.
In Tanzania, you see, because we were patrolling the huge shed. So we simply went downtown and bought a padlock. Bought a padlock. So next time we were on duty, we broke off the padlock and put our own padlock on there. And because we were commandos, we were obsessed with weapons. So we would go into this great big warehouse and there'd be weapons from all over the world. And we were just intrigued. We were ever so excited about this because weapons were our life. However, we stole 91 Lugers. And then we went to the ammunition dump and we stole a load of ammunition. We got away with it. So because we had the key and the padlock to the warehouse that we were patrolling. So when we came back through customs, dressed as commandos in khaki and green berets, and a four-ring skipper from the customs shouted out, "Stop." And we thought we were going to be arrested and imprisoned. He said, "Go over there and change your currency." So we got away with that. And then we got on the coat. However, we went back to Bickley. So then, in the evenings of the weekends down at Bickley in Devon, we were out illegally with our guns shooting at things in the woods. However, we had a visit from the chief of police, so we had what we call clear lower deck. Clear lower deck is a term used from the Navy where you may have a public flogging or somebody, so the whole of the ship's company comes up onto the deck and it's called clear lower deck. It means that, you know, we're going to punish this man, and it's a warning for the rest of you. You better behave, otherwise you're going to get the same. So it's clear lower deck. So the commando turned out, chief of police arrived and said, look, I know you guys, you people have stolen 91 Lugas. We said, no, not us. He said, I'll tell you a story about, you know, the illegal possession. When a weapon gets into the wrong hands, he said, it's okay, maybe okay with you, but you're going to sell it, and it's going to end up in the underworld. The guns are going to end up in the underworld of London. You know, Johnny Jack, here's the story. Johnny Jack goes ashore, buys a Luger, brings it home, puts it on the table and goes to work at the dockyard. Daughter comes along and said, oh, look, mummy, gun. Bang, bang, and it's loaded, and she kills her mother. That's what happens when weapons get into the wrong hands. So he said, I'm asking you now, if you hand in these 91 Lugas, I will give you an amnesty. He said, because if you don't abide by this request, if I catch you with a weapon, you know, you're going to have £1,000 fine, and you're going to have 2 years in jail. So we actually went away, and from the secret areas around our huts, it was like living in a prison war camp, you know, I emerged, you know, from the hut that I was looking after with, you know, two handfuls of Luger guns. And Luger, the 9mm Luger pistol, is it rather does something to people. It's an incredibly beautiful piece of German engineering, and it's exciting as owning that as owning a great big motorbike or a sports car would be to someone else. So then I went and saw the sergeant major and put two or three guns on the table with the accompanying ammunition, and nothing was said. So